Netanyahu delivers his controversial speech before Congress, but did it change any minds? Did it change yours? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Wednesday, we look at the arguments the Israeli Prime Minister made yesterday before Congress.
To defeat ISIS and let Iran get nuclear weapons would be to win the battle but lose the war. We can't let that happen.
Also, on the international front, does the death of outspoken Kremlin critic Boris Nemtsov mark a turning point? Our analysts today, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again. Jim McCormick is joining us in our Ames studio. Hello, Jim.
Good afternoon.
And we have on by phone, we have Wayne Moyer is with us in from Grinnell College. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Still getting my notes in shape here. We have a lot to talk about this hour, and a little bit later in the hour, of course, we want to talk about Benjamin Netanyahu's speech before Congress yesterday, this controversial visit, and we want to reach out to our listeners. What arguments? Perhaps you saw the entire thing. Perhaps you've been consuming, like most of us have, the news reports about that address to Congress. What arguments seem to make most sense to you in this debate? Also, we're hearing a lot of President Obama countering some of the things that the prime minister said. What makes sense to you? What has swayed you in this debate over trying to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons? Has your mind been changed by anything you've heard in recent days? Reach out to us via our social media, Iowa Public Radio on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk, 1-866-780-9100. Before we get to that, let's talk about this. Yesterday, the House voted 257 to 167 to keep the Department of Homeland Security funded through September, and that outcome was secured mostly by Democratic votes. What passed was a clean bill, so to say, without attached provisions to block spending on Obama's immigration orders. Now, gentlemen, what's interesting here, I think you'll find, too, is what's happened. This is a weeks-long saga. Let's go back 3 weeks ago. Speaker John Boehner said in a press conference that he couldn't rule out the possibility of a shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security, and that if funding for Homeland Security lapsed, the Democrats would bear responsibility.
The House has done its job. Why don't you go ask the Senate Democrats when they're going to get off their ass and do something other than to vote no?
All right. 3 weeks later, now he's passed the so-called clean bill without the amendments to limit President Obama's executive actions on Homeland Security. Wayne, explain what led to Boehner's defeat. Was this predestined, doomed from the start?
I think that it was. I think what finally caused the House opposition to collapse is the Senate passed a clean bill, and then the House wanted to negotiate their previous bill, which did include Homeland Security, and the Senate was unwilling to negotiate, or the House was unwilling to, or the Senate was unwilling to negotiate, and then the House either had to go in and pass a clean bill or Homeland Security would not be funded. And I think when it finally came to that point, Boehner had to back down.
Jim McCormick, in the final vote that passed this funding, two-thirds of the House GOP voted against Boehner's party. What does that tell you about this leadership? What's going on there in the House?
Well, I think he has a very raucous caucus, as he described it himself. It's very, you know, he has clearly some folks there that are unwilling to compromise with the administration at all. I think Boehner also recognized that he had lost the public debate battle on this issue. The other thing I think that undermined any efforts by the House was, of course, last week that Senator McConnell said that he would have separate votes on both, if you will, a clean bill and also a vote on immigration. And, of course, the vote on immigration would be subject to presidential veto, so it was sort of meaningless. I think Boehner has still said they're going to have a vote on an immigration bill, but this has sort of gone away because I think the public relations battle was really lost over the past 3 weeks. I think the other complication of this story is, of course, the Texas District Court decision. And I suspect that Boehner and some
explain
of his allies—
that, please. Explain that, please, Jim.
Yeah, this was a decision to actually hold in abeyance, if you will, the presidential executive order on immigration here. And, of course, the administration has appealed the decision and calling for a stay of that decision by the district court. But I checked this morning. As of this morning, they still had not the district judge had not yet made a decision, and the administration was still waiting to appeal to the appeals court in New Orleans. So they might be able to point to that as a part of the rationale for, you know, going to a clean bill. But I think one other factor I'll just enter in. I saw this kind of exchange that Nancy Pelosi had on Friday. She said that she had been promised a clean bill for getting the one-week extension that passed on Friday. So I think this was probably Boehner living up to that that statement.
Mm. I wonder, was Boehner had to cooperate with the minority leader, Nancy Pelosi, to get this vote through. Wayne, do you see that as a sign of things to come? Is this the way a lot of votes will look in the coming months?
I think there's a very good chance that this is the way things will go. There will be important bills that need to get passed, and this group of Tea Party conservatives that has been blocking everything, if it continues to do that, the only way to get legislation through will be to rely on Democrats. And I don't think the Republicans want to do that. I don't think Boehner wants to do it. But the public relations flack that the Republicans are likely to take if they can't show that they can govern, I think will add strong pressures to get things done.
Mm-hmm. So what, Jim, do you see anything that the conservative right of the GOP can do if they are ignored, as Wayne seems to indicate they may be?
Well, they don't have very many options. They do want to demonstrate that they can govern. But also, you know, I suppose they'll be looking over their shoulder to see if they don't hold to their principles, whether they will be subject to a primary fight. So they might well still, there would be, I suppose, maybe several dozen that would hold to their principled position rather than compromise. But I think Wayne's right. What we'll see is probably some Democrats coming on board. But I also think, you know, there were only 75 Republicans that voted for this final measure, you know, out of, what, 247 so that are in the House. So I think some of them will probably move to this kind of more compromising position.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, it's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we have with us Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at the Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Let's move on to the action yesterday in Congress. For days, we've been hearing reports and discussions about this much-anticipated, controversial Congress address before Congress. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, visiting the U.S. with this. We want to listen to some excerpts from it and reach out to you. You've been listening to the news reports. Perhaps you caught the thing in its entirety. What arguments make most sense when you hear this debate more or less going on between Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama with John Kerry at his side? This debate over trying to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. What stands out for you? Has your mind been changed by anything you've heard in recent days? Well, join us on our social media, Iowa Public Radio on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk, 1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to talk. Join this discussion. The president's job of selling a potential nuclear agreement with Iran to a skeptical Congress became far harder yesterday after this passionate and controversial speech by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Let's listen to one of the volleys he launched.
Iran's regime is as radical as ever. Its cries of death to America, that same America that it calls the Great Satan, as loud as ever. Now, this shouldn't be surprising, because the ideology of Iran's revolutionary regime is deeply rooted in militant Islam. And that's why this regime will always be an enemy of America. And don't be fooled. The battle between Iran and ISIS doesn't turn Iran into a friend of America. Iran and ISIS are competing for the crown of militant Islam. One calls itself the Islamic Republic. The other calls itself the Islamic State. Both want to impose a militant Islamic empire, first on the region and then on the entire world. They just disagree among themselves who will be the ruler of that empire. In this deadly game of thrones, there's no place for America or for Israel, no peace for Christians, Jews, or Muslims who don't share the Islamist medieval creed, no rights for women, no freedom for anyone. So when it comes to Iran and ISIS, the enemy of your enemy is your enemy.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking before Congress yesterday. Join our discussion. Were you swayed by any of the arguments made by Netanyahu? The other ones we've heard from President Obama or John Kerry? 1-866-780-9100. Join us on Facebook as that discussion continues, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me reach out to our guests, Jim and Wayne. Jim, you first, your reaction to the Netanyahu speech and all that led up to it.
Well, I thought it was both a decisive kind of speech. He really laid out some of the arguments about the problems with dealing with Iran, whether it's, you know, allowing inspectors in or their activities in the region in terms of terrorism and so on. But I also think it was a challenging speech for the Obama administration. And I think of it in kind of two ways here. If you think of it ironically, it actually may help the administration in their bargaining with Iran, because given the thunderous applause that Netanyahu got from the Congress, the Obama administration and Secretary of State Kerry can argue, you know, that there's going to really, if he doesn't have a deal that he can deliver at home, it's going to be no deal. So it may actually strengthen America's hand. The other way to look at it, it seems to me, and why it's a challenge for the administration, is I think given the way that Netanyahu laid out all of these kind of concerns that Israel has and he himself personally has with regard to Iran, it's going to make it a more difficult case for the administration unless they come really are really in a public debate over why what they will set out as the guidelines on March 24th really is convincing to the American public, because the American public as a whole and over time has obviously been very skeptical of Iran.
Wayne, do you see it that way?
I agree with what Jim is saying, but there's another angle to this as well, which I think is important, is Netanyahu did not lay out an alternative to what the administration is doing. And so then the question becomes, well, suppose the current negotiations fail. I think Netanyahu is assuming that somehow or other, if we keep sanctions in place, the Iranians will be forced back to the negotiating table. But I worry whether we can keep current sanctions in place, because it involves Russia as well as Germany and France and Great Britain and even China. And the interim agreement certainly cuts back on Iran's nuclear program. And if the negotiations fail and the sanctions come undone, Iran actually will be able to speed up their nuclear program. So the question I think that has to be asked is, will we be worse off if the negotiations fail than if the negotiations continue?
And do we have an answer to that question, Wayne? Do you?
I think it's a big chance to take. I worry very much if the negotiations fail that we'll be able to get a tougher deal than already is being negotiated with Iran.
Join us with your thoughts, your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Suzanne is with us from West Des Moines. You followed it, Suzanne, it sounds like. What's on your mind? What question do you have?
Well, you know, I just find it unbelievable that these days we listen to people like the Prime Minister of Israel, who has his own extreme position of blatantly, making the same mistake Israel has made for decades by blatantly monopolizing and withholding resources and trampling all over the human rights of all the communities around them, and then wondering why people want to kill themselves just to kill, you know, just to get back at them. I can't believe this is this Prime Minister talking is the same administration that withheld taxes to Gaza and Palestine in response to them simply wanting to join the UN. So, it's unrealistic to think that we can withhold technology from any nation. So maybe promoting a policy where we're just not egocentric idiots to the rest of the world.
Aren't you scared by an Islamic Republic, Iran, with nuclear weapons?
Sir. Absolutely. But, as human nature would have it, these are unrealistic goals. We've proven, the U.S. and Israel both have proven what happens when you have, colonization, trampling all over other people, impoverishing them. You want to know where all the extremists comes from? It's from, trampling over human rights of other people.
Okay, Suzanne.
Impoverishing them and monopolizing resources.
Suzanne, I think we got it. Thank you from West Des Moines. Let's move on to another view. Eric in Marion. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. What's your point?
Well, my point is one of the things that they brought up is that we had dropped sanctions, partially dropped some of our sanctions to get to the bargaining table. And at this point, they've allowed us only one of the inspections out of 12 different agreements that we had as part of the dropping the sanctions that were in place. I have absolutely no trust and the Iranians to move forward if we sign a new deal with them to allow us to do any more. It's always been the bait and switch with these guys. And then the other part of it, people keep on talking about, well, maybe, Congress will make them think that, gosh, it's even going to be tougher. Well, who is anybody shocked about the fact the Iranians may not even pass this?
Mm. Okay. Eric, good question. Jim McCormick. Whatever deal is struck or is not, can we trust the Iranians?
Well, I think that was the theme of Netanyahu's speech yesterday: is that we can't trust the Iranians. The issue is, of course, and what the caller is really referencing is that there have been, some six different UN resolutions. With regard to both enrichment and dealing with inspections of Iran's nuclear sites here. And, the record is not very encouraging. I mean, Iran signed something called the Additional Protocol of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but it hasn't put into effect and it has thwarted the kind of inspection. So I think that's what the caller is referencing here. And I think that, frankly, that's a real tangible kind of problem. I wanted to just add one other thing, and I agree with Wayne's point about, what's the alternative here. And I would just add one other thing, that the failure to get an agreement and trying to ramp up the sanctions may actually increase the sense of nationalism within Iran itself, the sort of a rally kind of effect. So I think that sort of is the other yet another component that makes not getting a deal more dangerous, if you will.
Okay, let's go back to an excerpt from the speech that Prime Minister Netanyahu gave before a joint meeting of Congress yesterday. Then we'll have some words from President Obama. He spoke before this speech yesterday before the press. Let's juxtapose those, get some more reaction from the phone and from our guest. This is Benjamin Netanyahu talking about the path, the concessions that he sees being made by the deal that is underway.
So you see, my friends, this deal has two major concessions. One, leaving Iran with a vast nuclear program. and two, lifting the restrictions on that program in about a decade. That's why this deal is so bad. It doesn't block Iran's path to the bomb. It paves Iran's path to the bomb. So why would anyone make this deal? Because they hope that Iran will change for the better in the coming years? Or they believe that the alternative to this deal is worse? Well, I disagree. I don't believe that Iran's radical regime will change for the better after this deal. This regime has been in power for 36 years, and its voracious appetite for aggression grows with each passing year. This deal would only whet Iran's appetite for more.
Okay, why would anyone want this deal? Let's hear the president on that question, more or less. Here he is speaking yesterday before a meeting with Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, President Obama, with the talk more or less answering Netanyahu's claims.
Now, the alternative that the Prime Minister offers is no deal, in which case Iran will immediately begin once again pursuing its nuclear program, accelerate its nuclear program, without us having any insight into what they're doing, and without constraint. And his essential argument is that if we just double down on sanctions, Iran won't want to do that. Well, we have evidence from the past decade that sanctions alone are not sufficient to prevent Iran from pursuing its nuclear ambitions. And if it, in fact, does not have some sense that sanctions will be removed, it will not have an interest in avoiding the path that it's currently on.
Okay, President Obama yesterday, what's swayed your mind? Has your mind been changed by anything you've heard in recent days? 1-866-780-9100, Iowa Public Radio, also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Jim, can you tell us, we haven't heard much of the Iranian perspective here. What do they want? Do we know?
I don't think we do know. I think the supreme leader has to decide whether they're actually going to pursue a nuclear weapon or not. That's sort of the best intelligence that I have, or best intelligence that I've seen, is that a final decision has not been made. I think the larger point that Iran wants to do, of course, it wants to be a leader in the region. And, you know, nuclear weapons not only gives you that kind of prestige factor, but it would give them sort of dominance in the Middle East, if you will.
And we would anticipate that perhaps their behavior would change, become more extreme with nuclear weapons. We've seen that in North Korea, haven't we?
That would be the assumption, is that they could be even more daring than the actions that they've taken, although they obviously are, as the Prime Minister pointed out, had some success in terms of influence, whether it's in Iraq or in Yemen, and maybe as far away as Libya as well.
Okay, we'll be back with more in our discussion. We have Jim McCormick of Iowa State University with us, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, talking about, well, the main event in this politics day. As we look back over recent political events, we're focusing on the speech given yesterday by Benjamin Netanyahu before Congress. We'd like to have your input. You hear anything that's changed your mind, a point that you want to make that you don't feel is being made? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Back with more in just a few minutes. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday with Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, Jim McCormick, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Iowa State University. We hope you'll join us with the discussion, mainly talking about the speech yesterday. It was passionate. It was controversial. The speech by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Congress. What was it to you? 1-866-780-9100. Gail writing on our Facebook page, the other side of the coin is, who should Iran trust? Our history of involvement there The Shah is not a good one. Secondly, President Obama was criticized for sanctions, which worked, and now is being criticized for trying to negotiate. I am tired of the naysayers and think negotiation is always better than war, which is the only Republican solution, writes Gail on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Let's go back to our guests, but first, let's listen to President Obama. We heard a couple excerpts from Netanyahu in that speech, but President Obama has been providing his counterpoint to Netanyahu's arguments. Here he is yesterday speaking with reporters.
We don't yet have a deal. It may be that Iran cannot say yes to a good deal. I have repeatedly said that I would rather have no deal than a bad deal. But if we're successful in negotiating, then in fact this will be the best deal possible to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Nothing else comes close. Sanctions won't do it. Even military action would not be as successful as the deal that we have put forward. And I think it is very important not to be distracted by the nature of the Iranian regime's ambitions when it comes to territory or terrorism, all issues which we share a concern with Israel about and are working consistently with Israel on, because we know that if, in fact, they obtained a nuclear weapon, all those problems would be worse.
President Obama speaking yesterday. Jim, we had Wayne address this in the first half of the program. Now, to you, is the best deal we can make with the Iranians better than no deal at all? Your thoughts?
Oh, I think that's probably right. I guess what I worry about is whether the deal can be enforced, and I think that's really the sort of the $64,000 question here about whether there will be compliance with it and whether we can hold together, the other P5 plus one, all the other participants in this to hold Iran's feet to the fire in terms of any deal. I think getting a deal is obviously very desirable. It's not quite the case that Netanyahu didn't say there was an alternative. He said there was a better deal. I mean, he didn't lay out. That's fair enough. But I think what the Israelis want, of course, is the destruction of some of the infrastructure for building nuclear weapons here within Iran. And I think that's probably unlikely. And also it's the case that uranium enrichment, the preliminary agreement going back to November of 2013, already basically conceded that Iran could engage in uranium enrichment. So I think there's a limited kind of window here of what's really possible in terms of a deal.
If I could just add a little bit to that. In terms of destroying a large part of Iran's nuclear structure, this is just to follow on to what Jim is saying. The question, I don't think that is negotiable. And so then the question is, if that is our goal, which I think is what Netanyahu is saying, then if we can't do it through negotiations, how else can we do it? And the only other means that I can see is the use of military force. And considering our military involvements in the Middle East, are we ready to use military force again?
We know, though, that if the U.S. doesn't act, the Israelis have demonstrated in the past they will act unilaterally.
Well, that's always a risk. But then there's the question of whether even military action will be able to destroy the capabilities. I think in some sense the genie's out of the bottle. They know how to enrich uranium. If we take military action, this is not something that's going to be ended by a few airstrikes. And the only way that we would really destroy the program is to send troops in.
Jim, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I don't think the Israelis have the capacity to actually destroy some of those underground facilities here. And it's also a question whether the U.S. has the military capacity to do that. But more than that, whether the military itself is really committed to that. At least some analysis suggests that even some of those within the Pentagon would be very reluctant to to take on that task because they might not may well not be successful. And of course, the response would be for Iran to attack some of our friends within the region, as well as maybe retaliatory strikes here within the U.S. Of a kind of a suicide nature or what have you.
Let's go to Richard in Cedar Rapids. Richard, what's on your mind as we talk about the speech yesterday, the controversy?
Well, the general controversy of nations acquiring nuclear weapons, we have an interesting example that has kind of a side impact, and that is with regard to the Ukraine. The Ukraine gave up weapons that it already had, and many nations could look at them and say, this is not going well. And I'm curious what impact that might have on the whole issue.
Hmm. Wayne or Jim, any thoughts there?
Well, the only thing I could say is, that may be one reason why the Iranians might want nuclear weapons, that the regime does feel insecure and does feel that the United States and other countries do want to undercut it and overthrow it. And with nuclear weapons, that would make military action against them almost impossible.
I very much agree. I think that's that would be a real deterrent effect, if you will, for other states to intervene or to take action against Iran.
Jim McCormick is with us, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim of Iowa State University. Let's get to a couple of other items here. This will be chewed over for days to come. Repercussions will follow that as well. But another big international political event yesterday in Moscow, thousands of Russians filing past the coffin of Boris Nemtsov, the Kremlin critic, killed last week, shot in the back four times on Friday, and within the sight of the Kremlin walls is where this killing took place. Friends of Nemtsov say it shows the hazards of speaking out against Russian President Putin. They say he was a victim of an atmosphere of hatred whipped up against anyone who opposes the president. Aides to Putin deny any involvement in killing Nemtsov. Nemtsov, former deputy prime minister, also the most prominent opposition figure to be killed in Russia during Putin's 15-year rule. Wayne, does this killing change anything?
I think it's too soon to say. It certainly puts a chill in terms of dissenters and as intimidating to them. Whether it mobilizes them more, I don't know. But what I've found surprising is the huge turnouts afterwards. You know, we've been hearing all these stories that Putin is rising 83-84% in terms of public opinion. But with these very large demonstrations, that to me means that there are still very substantial opposition, at least at some levels, even though it doesn't show up at the public opinion polls.
Jim?
Well, I very much agree. I mean, it does have that kind of a chilling effect on demonstrators, but by these turnouts, they haven't been chilled very much, it seems to me. But I guess I find it hard to believe that the Kremlin would not know, given the kind of efforts to gain control by Putin within Russia, would not know about this kind of killing that took place, particularly since it's just down the street from the Kremlin.
In fact, I don't know if you saw this, but reports, I think it was a BBC report I saw, showed with the camera no less than 18 video cameras, some on the Kremlin walls, pointed in this direction. So, you know, dozens of video cameras in one of the most watched places in Moscow, and there's not any recording of really what happened.
Sounds a little bit more than coincidental.
Are we likely to find out, Wayne, who was behind this?
I don't think so. There have been a number of other dissenters killed over the years, and to the best of my knowledge, there's never been anyone really apprehended in any of those cases.
What's intriguing about this, at least one report, was that Nemtsov had some information, was going to go public with some information about Russia's involvement in Ukraine. I mean, not that that's a great secret, it seems to me, but you know, that he was going to come out and do this, given his stature within Russia, you know, leads me to believe again that it's hard for me to believe that the Kremlin didn't know something about this.
Mm-hmm. So this incident will fade. I guess there are no other things. Boris Nemtsov is dead, And Russia, let's talk a little bit about Russia as a democracy, at least its aspirations at one time to be a democracy. Gennady Gudkov, he's a prominent Kremlin opponent, said in a speech delivered next to the coffin yesterday of Boris Nemtsov. Here's his quote. "The shots were fired not only at Nemtsov, but at all of us, at democracy in Russia. We never thought this could happen, but it did. Rest in peace, my friend. Your work will be continued." Jim, where does this leave hopes for democracy in Russia?
Well, I think it makes it very difficult to see the kind of transformation that we thought occurred, you know, back in basically 1991 to 1993, when there was a real movement towards democratic control, if you will, even a little bit earlier than that, even before the collapse of the Soviet Union here. But I think since then, since Putin and Medvedev have been in power, you know, there's been really a collapse of any kind of democracy and much more centralized control. And that's evident even in terms of the media as well.
Mm-hmm. No sign, Wayne, that Putin could be dislodged in any way.
Not immediately. I mean, Russians historically have loved having a very strong leader. It's a very, very big country with very long borders. And there's some sense that they feel more security under Putin than they did under Yeltsin in the interim period after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And this desire to have a strong leader and a stable government, I think at least for the foreseeable future, is likely to make it very difficult for dissenters or for people who want to move more in a democratic direction.
This story out of Moscow really taking center stage. We still have the war in Ukraine. Jim, what have you seen in the latest there? We had a ceasefire go into effect. What are you seeing?
Well, the immediate reaction on the ceasefire was that it didn't go into effect, but there seems to be some more signs that it, you know, that it may be going into effect. Although there are, you know, I just noticed even this morning that there was an explosion in a mine. I don't know if that was done intentionally or was indeed an accident, but it was in the eastern part of the country. The Minsk agreement has been said, if the Minsk agreement falls apart, I mean, what are really the options here except, you know, more actions by the West, and maybe that will mobilize, you know, certainly Germany has a great stake in the Minsk agreement, and Chancellor Merkel has put a lot of her diplomatic skill on that agreement. And so if that were to fail, I think that she would be much more inclined, as well as would be France, to take even more actions against Russia.
Let me add just a couple of things to that. Inspectors have been unable to verify that either side has withdrawn their heavy weapons, and that's a matter of concern. So that we don't know for sure that the big guns have been pulled back. The second thing is that Merkel did say, I think it was today, that if in fact the ceasefire is not respected, that then she will move ahead with sanctions. This is just to confirm what Jim was saying.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the conflict, the fight against ISIS on many fronts continues. Also a tie-in, evidently, with the Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech warning the enemy of your enemy is your enemy. Now, this is amid the negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, drawing attention to Iran's presence in Iraq, supporting local forces fighting the Islamic State group and fighting most recently to take back the city of Tikrit from the Islamic State. So, Jim, here we have the U.S. and Iran on the same side. Are they allies or are they not?
Well, I think they're trying to show that they're not allies, because the Americans apparently have withdrawn any kind of bombing in terms of the effort to take back Tikrit. So I think there's probably sode voce, kind of a silent kind of assistance by the Americans, but not any kind of public display that they're cooperating with, as it turns out, the Revolutionary Guard from Iran, that apparently is part of the efforts with regard to Crete.
Could I just add something that I find very troubling about this? The ISIS massacred quite a number of the Sunnis as it went into Tikrit and went into Mosul. And if the Shiites with Iran's support go in and take Tikrit, and then there is a massacre of the Sunnis in response or in revenge, that seems to me that's going to make the whole struggle to overcome ISIS much more difficult.
Let's wind up with domestic politics, and more than domestic, Iowa politics. Of course, we're less than a year away from the Iowa caucuses, and this weekend, another 2016 cattle call forum. This Saturday's Iowa Agriculture Summit marks a milestone in the 2016 campaign. Jeb Bush will make his debut in Iowa in this election cycle. Also featured about a dozen GOP presidential contenders. 7 hours on Saturday before an audience of hundreds in Des Moines. Of course, a crush of national media. I want to get your thoughts on what you'll be watching for. But first of all, who can tell me where this idea of an ag summit in this 2016 nomination trail campaign came from anyway? This is put on by agribusiness leader Bruce Rastetter, who will be hosting it. Jim McCormick?
Well, I think his rationale for putting this together was that Iowa agriculture it should be a spotlight of the presidential race, that the Iowa agriculture, or agriculture generally, is an important issue that sometimes doesn't get the same kind of attention that it necessarily should in national campaigns. Certainly for any politician coming to Iowa, he's got to be ready to talk about ethanol and so on. So I think this is part of the effort, you know, also with the renewable fuel standards and the debate over that. I think that will be one of the issues that may well be highlighted at this Ag Summit, and where these candidates stand on that renewable fuel standard here.
If I could add just one thing quickly, I think the timing of this is absolutely impeccable, because this is the time to get all of the candidates here to Iowa, and in some ways it's a way to maximize the overall influence of agricultural concerns that people in Iowa and environmental concerns that people in Iowa have.
Mm-hmm. Also an interesting difference when we compare this with Steve King's Freedom Summit from several weeks ago. Each of the GOP presidential contenders will be doing a speech solo. They'll be doing, as I've read, a 20-minute question-and-answer session with Bruce Rastetter. So that's an interesting twist there.
Well, it'll be interesting to kind of how much Rastetter is able to challenge some of the candidates, whether he'll have the same script for all of the candidates. I think what the media will be watching is how Jeb Bush rolls himself out in Iowa. Mm. I think that'll be probably the focal point in terms of this summit. I just must add, on a personal note, this particular ag conference is clashing with the Iowa Association of Political Scientists that are meeting at Drake University on Saturday. So we'll see where the attendance is at.
Where will your attendance will be at?
I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
Wayne, what will you be watching for, whether you're there or are at another meeting of political scientists?
I'm particularly interested in the renewable fuels thing and where the candidates come down on renewable fuel subsidies.
You get the sense here, but we have a larger group of 2016 contenders here. Jeb Bush is there. We had that Freedom Summit put on by Steve King a while ago. That was more or less the conservative wing of the GOP, and this one is all welcome or all willing to come, right?
And even I think Patty Judge is coming, who's a Democrat, not running for anything, so far as I know. But it'll be less ideologically centered, I guess, even though I will be largely Republican.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you see front runners here at any point? Quickly, we have about a minute left. Jim, who do you look to?
Well, I think Scott Walker is going to be also, along with Jeb Bush, is going to be sort of in the spotlight to see if he continues to kind of dominate as he did at the King Summit a few weeks ago here.
Mm-hmm. Wayne?
I agree. neither, I'm not quite clear where either of them stands on a whole range of issues relating to environment and agriculture. So it will be very interesting. I agree with Jim that those are the two to watch most closely.
Okay. Very good. Well, we'll definitely report on that. Keep listeners up to date. Follow it with glee, as we do so often on Politics Day. Thank you very much. Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at the Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all the listeners. We didn't get to a number of the Facebook posts or tweets, but thank you so much for calling in and giving us your views as well. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Also thanks to Julia Davis. Jason Burns helped us out in Ames today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime. Our email address is rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.